And welcome back to Talent Gone Wild with Best Entertainers and our hosts, Vic and Lou.
I'm really excited about tonight's program. Today we have one of the greatest artists I've ever known. He's earned every single moment of his accolades in the theater world. Over a dozen successful and acclaimed albums now. He's been one of the most incredible pianists, arrangers. Welcome to Talent Gone Wild, Billy Stritch.
Hey guys, how you doing?
We're great.
That's a nice introduction. That's a very nice introduction.
Oh, you deserve every bit of it.
Thank you.
I see you every Thursday at Billy's place, and it's wonderful. Really exciting for me.
Yep, that's my gig this year for sure.
It's great.
Yeah. That's really a blessing, I think, that you do that show during this time.
It's such a miracle that we have the technology. I've often remarked to friends of mine that if this whole thing had happened 20 or 30 years ago, anyone like me who does this, there'd be no way to do our shows, you know.
No outlet. Yeah.
And what we're doing right now, I mean, it's just amazing. So that's a good part of it. I've always tried to look for the good part.
Well, it's one of my happy places, and I haven't gotten, but I ordered three of your albums for my relatives, and
you should be getting them any second. They were gone. They went out a couple days ago, so you should.
Oh, good, you saw them. Okay, great.
Oh yeah, I saw them. No, it all, Lewis. It all comes through me. So that's yeah, that's right.
Oh, okay.
But I'll hold it up for those of you.
Hey.
I happen to have a copy or about 300. This is an album that I did this year, and it was so great to actually, first of all, it's been 13 years since my last solo album.
What?
I know. I mean, that's how crazy time is. I couldn't believe it either. And then when this whole quarantine thing happened and I started doing my Billy's Place shows on Thursdays, it's just me at the piano, you know, for an hour, and it's different composers or tributes to different singers. About 4 months into it, I thought, you know, this would be a good album. I have a lot. I had already found a lot of favorite songs over the past.
Yeah. I love the Billy's Place song, too.
Thank you. I made a little theme song. So I called my good friends at Club 44 Records down in Nashville, where I had already done a couple of projects. And they said, come on down. And we recorded it very quickly. Just me and a piano, and it came out in October. So I'm thrilled to have a new CD product to sell with some of my favorite music. Yeah.
How many albums does this make?
Well, this is my sixth solo album, but I've played on so many other people's albums. I've been on duet albums with Christine Ebersole and with Clea Blackhurst and Max von Essen and different people, and of course sang here and there on lots of other things. So I've been in the recording studio a few times, but this is just my sixth solo album. So,
yeah. Well, just.
Yeah. Well,
the first show that I saw you did with Linda Lavin, and she's her downstairs. She's
three floors above me, actually.
Oh, okay.
She's not there now, but she has an apartment right above me.
Now, wait, I met Billy for the first time when we booked Montgomery Plant Stritch. But
right.
You've known him since high school, right?
Not high school.
College.
Yeah.
College. We brushed paths in college for sure.
I wasn't
at U of H very long. I was just there really a year. I had spent a year at North Texas State, and that wasn't my best experience. It was fine, but you know, I was too young. I was away from home, so it was I didn't buckle down on my studies.
Yeah, first year for anybody.
And then I went to U of H, and that's where I met you, and that's where I met Sharon Montgomery and Sally Mays.
Right.
And that's where we started the group. And I got so involved in I'd always loved drama, but I was doing North Texas music. And then I got to know the drama people. And that's really who I wanted to hang out with, you know, the people with, you know, that sensibility. So that's
what year was that? Around 90?
That year would have been 1980 into 81.
81, right.
81. Yeah. And I ended up doing Two Gentlemen of Verona. Sydney Berger directed it with Sharon and Janet Adderley. Do you remember Janet Adderley?
Oh, sure.
You know? Yeah. I mean, it's like a lot of great people. That's 14
years. I was really kind of going out at that time because I was working at the Million Dollar City Dump.
Right.
And I was doing comedy at the Comedy Workshop.
Right.
So I was kind of in and out. But
Yes.
I had just started the Texas Mime Theater with Casey, and we were very quietly in our room because that's what mimes do.
Sure, sure. Well,
but you, no, you were out in the lobby or in the coffee area with Montgomery, Mays, and Stritch.
Oh, organizing. Yeah, and we were rehearsing, you know, we were just figuring it out. And it was just like we had all this time between classes. So I'd wheel an upright piano to the lobby of the Wortham Theater or just wherever. And we just find a corner. And it was like just a really intense little period, because what happened is we'd sung together at a party and everybody said, you know, we just fell into this three-part harmony just quite naturally. And so everybody encouraged us to do it. And so we went and got a booking at a club, and we had to learn 3 hours worth of material in 2 weeks. So that was that period you're thinking of. We were in the corner, like madly rehearsing and learning.
Wow. Did you know that I dated Sharon? Well, I went on one date with Sharon Montgomery.
You dated.
Fingers and toes.
Yeah. Sharon goes, okay, let's dress the nines. I asked her out. She goes, let's dress the nines. And my wardrobe consisted of mostly track outfits.
You were doing stand-up comedy. What do you expect? You know, it's not the most dressy profession.
I had my bar mitzvah suit, which was the closest I had to the nine. So instead of the nines, I had the threes in my wardrobe.
The threes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Were you always attracted to the Great American Songbook?
From the time I was really young, I remember... I loved TV. I loved variety shows. I remember, begging my parents to let me stay up to watch Carol Burnett's show and all the variety shows that were in the early 70s. And that's where I got my first exposure to like Gershwin music and Irving Berlin.
Oh, really?
Because Carol Burnett would always do big musical sequences at the very end of her show. And it would quite often be like a throwback to an old movie of Fred and Ginger or something like that. So those songs got in my ear, and that was around the same time that I started playing by ear as well. So I would record the songs in a little cassette player, a little portable one that I saved my money and bought. And then I'd run to the living room and I'd try to figure out the song. So, kind of all started to happen when I was 9 or 10 or 11. So always for me, it was the Great American Songbook. I always feel like I was an old soul musically. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was hearing about you, I think even before you came to U of H, you were kind of like poised to me, like you were Sheldon, prodigy, you know?
Well, I had already worked a lot in clubs, even that early. So, I had already started to, I started playing professionally when I was 14. And then as soon as I could work, things were a little looser there. I mean, I do remember like working with a singer in a bar, and I probably wasn't even 18, but I was playing the piano and I had suits and ties, you know, so nobody, I don't remember ever getting held up by that. So
you did these incredible vocal arrangements with Sally and Sharon later Plant. And how did you already know you had a talent for this kind of arrangement?
No, I didn't. I'd never done that. I mean, it was just like all of a sudden there's these two girls who I'm bonding with right away, and they love to sing just like I love to sing. And we could all hear harmonies because we'd all sung in church. So we all had that kind of an ear. So no, I had never done it before or considered doing it. I mean, so much of it wasn't planned. And then that's how I fell into vocal arranging, because we were with Sally. And then, as you say, Rebecca Plant. And in total, that was almost 9 years. So the arrangements got much more sophisticated as I went along as well, you know, but that just came out of the situation.
Yeah, in fact, when we booked you, that was January 1990, and that was for, in fact, the International Society of Special Events.
Yeah.
You're doing the talent for that. And then suddenly, after that, soon after that, you guys
Yeah, I was going to say, that would have been the very end, just about the very end. Yeah. We broke up at the end of 1990, so right before 1991. Mm-hmm. That was our last gig. And we had decided, you know, back the summer that we were going to, you know, go our separate ways by then, you know.
Oh, that's good.
A lot of traveling, a lot of touring, a lot of stress, you know.
I thought it might be me.
No. It's just, you know, we had done it for 7 years and the goal was always, of course, to get to the next level and have a record contract or get a TV show or, you know, I mean, all those things. And we had a manager in New York. We were working very hard at it, but, you know, it just wasn't happening. So I think we all at the same time were like, let's not, you know, beat our brains out over this. So
all over the world with the trio, right? I mean,
yeah, we had gone all over and a lot of jazz festivals in Europe as well. And a lot of whatever showrooms that were left, we did the Fairmont Hotel circuit, which was some great showrooms. And we worked quite a lot in New York. So by the time we broke up, we had spent so much time in New York and I have made such contacts there that it was very easy for me to decide that's where I needed to now permanently situate.
Now, so Sally left earlier. Did she leave to go to New York to pursue her solo?
She left to go to Dallas first. Oh. And she, was with a band there and writing songs with a songwriter and kind of involved in a situation there. And then eventually she did get to New York, but that didn't come right after her leaving the group. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you got to, and now I know you performed on the same bill with Sally later on in New York at a Christmas show.
Well, I did a show.
I
performed with Sally because Sally lives here. So we've done a lot of different one-nighters or galas or that kind of thing over the many years. I think the show you're thinking of was one I did called Billy and the Girls.
Right.
But also Sharon and Sally and I reunited at Birdland. We did a show and we had not sung together in 25 years, wow. At least longer. Longer. What am I thinking about? Longer than that. So we did a show about 5 years ago. I see Sally and certainly I'm in contact with her a lot because she's in New York.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I talked to her this week. Right. I said, so have you been watching Billy's Place? And she said, oh, yeah, of course. Of course.
Yeah. Sweet. Great.
So I know you've probably told this story a million times, but please, for Victoria's sake, tell us the Liza Minnelli story.
Anything for Victoria.
Right.
I'll try to keep it fairly brief. But I had worked 9 years, almost 9 years with the group. The group broke up New Year's. I moved to New York. So I'm in New York. It's the beginning of 1991. And I don't really know what the next move is going to be. I just know that I know people in New York. So that's made sense to be there. So I was friends with a man who owned a restaurant with a piano bar, a guy named Bob Nahas. And he gave me a couple of nights a week at his restaurant playing at the piano bar. And I also started to do my first solo cabaret shows as well, right around the same time, at a little club called 88 down in the village. Seated about 70 people. Mm. Fantastic. Gone now, sadly. But anyway, I would go in to do my nights at this club called Bobo's. And Bob would invariably say, oh, you just missed her. She was here last night. Oh, she was here on Saturday.
Oh, God.
So it became pretty clear that she was a regular and that I was going to meet her. I just knew there was no doubt that I was going to meet her. So a week or two later, I remember going in and there was nobody there. It was probably five in the afternoon, except for this one table way across the room with four women all dressed in black. And Bob kind of walks by and goes, there they are. So, and I knew at the time Liza was getting ready to do a big, big spectacular Radio City Music Hall because there were ads on the side of every bus and on the top of every cab. You couldn't cross the street without seeing Liza Radio City Music Hall. So she was, something was happening, but everything was buzzing. So I know they're there. There's no one else there. And I, you know, I've always never been the kind of guy to knock somebody over the head. I thought in that moment, well, I'm not going to play New York, New York or cabaret. I mean, it's just nobody here. Who would I play? You know, I mean, it's just didn't even occur to me. So I'm just playing my thing. And then I remember this great, great theme from a movie called The Bad and the Beautiful, which is a great old film noir with Lana Turner and Kirk Douglas. And it was directed by Vincent Minnelli. And it's got a fantastic score by a guy named David Raxon. And the theme is beautiful. And I played it for years. So I start to play that and I see her stiffen and I see her back. And I get about halfway through toward the end, and she gets up and she slowly makes her way across the room. Nobody was in the room practically. Eyes locked, you know, there was, she came right over. She told me later that she had been listening to the piano, but because her back was to it, she thought it was some old man, you know, playing some great old guy who just played for years, you know, and didn't realize till she turned around, there was like this 29-year-old kid. I was 29. And, she sat down next to me, introduced herself, you know, hi, I'm Liza. Yeah, I know. And the when she tells it, she always says that, you know, when she sat down on the bench next to me, I kind of gave her a look like, really, you're sitting on my piano, bitch? I don't think I would have done that. But long story short is we really, really hit it off that night. As the night went on, more people showed up. All of a sudden, there was a lot of people around the piano bar. So people were singing and she sang at one point. And by the end of the night, we had just bonded and she was inviting me to come to the rehearsals for the Radio City show. And so I started doing that. I met a lot of great people. I knew some of the women involved in that show because Lewis, that show, the second act of that show was Liza and 12 women. So that sang and danced all different ages. Mm. And the conceit of it was that she starts the second act by herself. And then in the middle of the song, this very average looking middle-aged woman jumps up and said, hey, Liza, and cuts her off. And then these 12, and they were all different ages. It was adorable, but there was a lot of vocal arranging. So as I'm going every day, just so thrilled to be there, I started to meet the piano player and they, you know, Liza was like, you got to hear this kid. And anyway, I started kind of throwing in ideas and they were asking about a week and a half into it, I got hired to create the vocal arrangements for that show. So that was my first big New York credit and the beginning of life with Liza, which, immediately was very intimate and intense and, a great relationship that I've
You know, I have never heard this full story, and what a lesson for anyone coming up. I mean, first of all, yes, most pianists would have played New York, New York, or for Cabaret, sure. One of the songs that she did with Judy Garland.
Any one of those things. Yep.
Yeah. And that's brilliant to go to her father, which she probably hasn't heard.
Well, I had been around enough. I've been around enough showbiz by that point, and we worked a lot in New York. And I knew Chita Rivera and Julie Wilson and Margaret Whiting, and I knew enough to know that, you know, you have to kind of approach it obliquely a little bit. You can't like knock them over the head with, "Hey, I know who you are. I'm playing your song," that kind of thing. So, but yeah, it worked for me. In that case, it really worked.
And want to entertain her. Right. You didn't just want to say,
that's right.
You know,
that's right. Yeah.
But also, you must have been able to talk to these people while you were seeing the show in a way that either didn't threaten them or added to what they were thinking, or, you know, I mean.
Yeah, I was never afraid to, you know, throw my opinions or my tastes in a situation like that with a singer or with a performer soon upon meeting them. You know, and it's a very mutual thing. You can definitely get the sense from the person if that kind of thing is welcomed, you know. Mm-hmm. And I've been lucky that most of the singers that I've worked with are, you know, who are in that league, have been very open and very collaborative. And, you know, I always felt very much like I had permission to be myself and share my opinion and laugh with them and be, you know, not too formal, not too stiff. You know, you can gauge the person, but you know, I mean, it's so much fun when you can just kick back, you know, the person's not, doesn't take themselves too seriously. So,
and you can really be creative.
Yeah. That's, and that little wall comes down and all of a sudden there's no, you know, it's just a great energy flowing back.
Yeah. And you're talking about the music.
Act, the humor, you know, because there was a lot of humor in Liza's shows and different.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and then working in cabaret, invariably, you know, you select material that's humorous. And so it's more than just music. It's everything to do with just the entire content of, you know, of an act. of a performance, you know. But yeah, it certainly started off with the music for sure. Yeah.
Well, you did the Radio City Music Hall show with Liza, and then you did her Broadway show, and you were more involved with that show.
Well, she did two. She did one called Minnelli on Minnelli, and that was a tribute to her father, and that was 1999. And then we did one 9 years later called Liza's at the Palace, which was a fantastic show, which was the second act of that was a tribute to her godmother, Kay Thompson. It was a fantastic.
Kay Thompson was a godmother?
Wow.
Yeah. You know Kay Thompson,
who wrote... I am mad at for only doing one movie.
Oh, I know. Yeah, exactly. Funny face. Well, she's also in Tell Me That You Love Me, Junie Moon. She's got a very small part in that, but
it's
very hard to find her. But there's some old movies where she's
a wonderful actress. I was.
Yeah. You know,
that was the only one she did. Maybe it's the only musical she did.
Very few. Very, very few. Yeah. You know, she was more behind the scenes. Certainly. I mean, she'd always performed on radio and she always did perform, but she fell into MGM and did a lot of she was the vocal arranger there for most of the late 40s and early 50s. And that's how she became so connected to Judy Garland. Yeah. And then, and by extension, Liza, you know, and
that's why
she's the god. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I knew Kay, you know, the very end of her life. You know, I mean, Kay was great. How did we get onto that subject?
It was me. I jumped in.
Victoria.
Sorry. Oh, the two shows, the two Broadway shows. Yeah. So I worked on both of those. Lewis, the first one was the Minnelli show about her dad. So it was basically Liza, five guys, and they pretty much chronologically went through and did medleys and sequences great songs from her dad's film. So there was a lot of great material. And Bob Mackie did the costumes and it was a review kind of thing. And I was lucky to do most of those arrangements, but Marvin Hamlisch did about a third of the arrangements. And he was around for a lot of that at the beginning. And he was just incredible to know. It was funny because I was not available for the first few weeks that Liza could rehearse. I forget what I was doing. So, and she had to get a start on it because they had got an opening at the Palace Theater and it had to be then. It was going to be that December because something else was coming in the next year. So she was kind of racing the clock. So she called Marvin, her old friend, in, and he did about the first third of the show. And then I came in when I could and we created the rest of the show. But Marvin was so great because he stayed around to the end. And when the playbill came out on the show poster and all that, it said musical arrangements by Billy Stritch and Marvin Hamlisch. And I thought, that's got to be a mistake. That's not, someone's going to, I mean, Marvin Hamlisch's name is to come first. And I kind of sheepishly went to him the next day and I said, I'm sure this is wrong. You know, I feel weird about, and he said, what? And he looked at it and he goes, oh no, you did most of the work. You absolutely drove this train from beginning. I mean, you deserve top billing. And that's the kind of guy he was. I mean, he was the super most wonderful, nice.
That's great.
A little manic and a little bit, but funny, funny, funny.
Aren't all artists.
Yeah.
You know, there's a difference between someone liking you, like Liza Minnelli, and you caught on instantly. And there's a difference between that and then...
And someone not liking you. No,
well, yeah. But I mean, really trusting you, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And this is a person already a star, already had her way of singing, already had probably been taken advantage of before.
Oh,
and her mother certainly had. So
Yeah. I think, well, I can only speak to the creative part of that, but knowing Liza, I knew that she was always looking for new people, new styles to explore, new types of performing, new opportunities. And invariably, you know, because she did so much nightclub performing, invariably, she was looking for fresh people and fresh arrangers and fresh collaborators. And so I kind of just fell in with that and she trusted it because that's what she wanted. She told me early on, she said, I learned something great from my mother because she was with her mom a lot when they were doing the concerts, you know, she traveled with her a lot. And Judy had such a great appreciation for the musicians and the arrangers and all that, like Liza does. And the people who put the show together. And she said, my mom taught me always to surround myself with the best talent I could get, the top people in their field, because it doesn't take anything away from you. It just makes you look better. And so she said, I don't want to have people around me who I think I know more than. I mean, I want people who can spark me. So so that's the part, that's the trust. That's where that that next level, you know, comes from, that mutual need to communicate on that level.
You worked with the two ladies, mm-hmm. Actually three ladies for nine years.
Yes,
and
I did.
You worked, you know, with Liza. Did working with her and then Marvin Hamlisch, did that, how did that change your singing or your musical arrangements?
I'm not really aware of any specific reason, like that was the time something changed. You know, everything in my career has just gone from this, and then this little bridge appeared, and then I went from to this thing. I think if anything's changed, it's just the fact that I've been performing and been arranging for so long that my tastes have honed a certain direction. But that's a really hard question to actually pick apart, because you know, I think I always kind of had a certain sensibility and a certain level of talent. And then when you get a chance to work with these people, it's just it just makes it, you know, you're using the talent. And every time you have a job like that, your talent gets hopefully more open and bigger. You learn something from every gig. So I was just learning as I went.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Linda Davis and Reba McEntire did your song.
Sure. Well, that was totally out of left field. I had co-written the song called Does He Love You with Sandy Knox. And we wrote it for Montgomery Plant and Stritch, because we had been working, you know, a lot of the nightclubs, supper clubs, gay clubs all over. And a lot of what we did was very visual, especially, I mean, but them both being beautiful and always dressed in elegant clothes, right. And me at the piano being beautiful too, hopefully. Yeah. But we created this song, One's a Wife. One character is the wife and the other is the mistress. So it was a great way for them to actually perform a big dramatic number. So it was always the end of the evenings. And its song is called Does He Love You? Right. But the guys in the club used to always like, are you guys going to do the bitch fight next set? The bitch fight? That was what everybody called it, the bitch fight. Because there's a moment at the end of the song when they turn and they sing right to each other. And it's like, oh, and that would make the room go apart.
It's really a unique song, I think, because Jolene is someone pleading with someone not to take her man. And then the song with Brandy and Monica, which is closer, is first of all, it was done after yours.
Yes, way after. Yes.
Yeah. And it has a different feeling about it. Well, first of all, it's R&B and not, you know.
Why are we talking about them? Let's talk about my song some more.
I just want to finish up
how it got to Reba, which was just out of left field. We had written it for the group, and then Sandy moved to Nashville and started writing specifically country music. So she made a connection with a publisher. She was a staff writer. The song was demoed in 1985.
Wow.
Nothing really came of it, but it kind of floated around. At one point, Barbara Mandrell was going to record it. Oh. And then she got, unfortunately, in a car accident, so that didn't happen. At one point, there was Winona Judd and somebody were supposed to. Anyway, it never happened. And then I get a call from Sandy in 1993, and she said, Reba McEntire has just recorded our song. Wasn't like, what do you think if it had actually happened the week before? And she just found out. But that song had been floating around, and Reba had a young protege singer named Linda Davis, who she and her husband had signed to their management company, and they were touring together. And she was looking for a song for two women. And just by a weird turn of events, that cassette tape got into her hands, and she listened to it and recorded it. And within a month later, it was, you know, number one on the country chart. So just weird how that happened. But and so that I just wanted to bookend. Yeah, it won a lot of awards. It won Grammys. It won a country music award. It won, you know, a lot of industry awards. So it did really, really pretty well. And it's been covered a few times as well. But
I love it. I think it's one of the best country songs ever.
Thank you so much. We didn't set out to write it as a country song. It was a pop song, but you know, you add a steel guitar and Reba McEntire, and you got yourself a country song. But just to show you how different it is, Liza recorded it with Donna Summer on an album called Gently. And it's so way different, you know, but it's another great, very dramatic, over the top kind of version. It's a great, the two of them together.
I know you've acted prior. I mean, you acted in college.
A little bit. Yeah.
But then you act in 42nd Street on Broadway.
Well, it was hardly a stretch, Lewis. I had four lines, but I played the onstage piano player, and you know, it was the most magnificent revival of one of my favorite shows. The show had played 9 years in New York in the 80s, and then they opened it in 2001, and it was just bigger and better and over the top. And there was a cast of 54 people. And I got, I was very good friends with the director and co-writer of the show by this point. And so I asked him if he would put me in the show and create a little moment, you know, and I have a little piano moment, and I had four lines. And I got to, I mean, but it was so fun because I got to sing and dance to Lullaby of Broadway. Come along, come on along. Yeah. I mean, I just loved being on that stage, and I made so many friends. That's how I met Christine Ebersole.
Right.
And, you know, our act came out of that and two albums we've done and that great friendship, you know.
So was that kind of a dream come true performing on?
Yeah, it kind of, that was always something I wanted to do. I want to do it again. You know, I love that. I mean, going to a Broadway show every night, leaving your apartment and like, you know, you're going to make it there half an hour and you're going to be in that world. And it was a lot of people. It was a big world to jump into. It wasn't like doing a small little intimate show. So there was always drama and there was always fun and funny people and people dropping by. And especially in the first, you know, few months after we opened, I mean, Julie Andrews came and Ann Miller came.
Wow.
And Kay Ballard and Donna McKay, I mean, everybody came to see the show. And so many, Ann Miller came one night and was friends of the girl who played Peggy Sawyer. They had done a show together, a girl named Meredith Patterson. Fantastic. So they were friends. And Annie stayed till midnight to take pictures with everybody and sign. You know, she just wanted to hang out with the dancers. You know, it was great. All these young, fresh-faced kids, 42 kids. It's amazing.
Gypsies kind of hang out together, don't they? The dancers.
Yeah, I love that experience. You know, I'd never had that experience, and there's nothing like it. And I made some great friendships. And I, at the beginning of this whole pandemic, we all had a big Zoom call, and there must have been 100 people. And there were some people I didn't know because I was only on the show for a year and a half, and it went on and did another 3 years after that. And also there were some people from the tour that I didn't know, but it was great to kind of catch up and see what everybody was up to. And of course, Facebook keeps a lot of people connected.
Right.
But that relationship with Christine came out of that. And I just loved hearing her sing every night. She was kind of,
by this time, you must've had a number of people who wanted you to arrange their vocals.
I mean, yeah. Yeah. I was doing a few things for different people. I mean, I didn't like hang my hat out as a specific arranger because, you know, so I didn't really advertise that, but singers that I knew would come to me and we would set arrangements together. I was much more about accompanying singers and singing on my own. And that's really been the bulk of what I do. And it's what I love to do more than anything.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, obviously you could have gone in that direction. You could have, the musical director arranger. You could have become the songwriter.
I see what's happening now. I think I could have done that. Yeah, I know. Yeah. I could have done it. I guess it's not too late, but you know, these young kids, there's so many great people orchestrating now. And it's the technology is so different, you know. I mean, so much of it's done in different ways than when I was coming up, when everyone was kind of, I mean, I'm not 80 years old. But, you know, you it would be real musicians in a real big room together and more often than not. And then we'd add things here and there. But
well, I want to talk about some highlights because you'd already started getting really, I mean, you were already well known. Your song is number one now. You're doing these shows with Liza. And then 2006, 2007, for instance, this year, you act, you sing, you play piano in Amanda Green's off-Broadway show. You have a successful run at Birdland with Billy Stritch and the girls.
Right.
You're doing the Iridium, the Christmas show with Lainey Kazan.
I did do that. Yeah. I remember that. That's been a while. Yeah.
Then you do the Hoagy Carmichael tribute at the Manhattan Metropolitan Room. You've got several albums you're doing. And then you do the Mel Torme show. How do you do all of this?
Well, it's so weird because I didn't actually realize until you just said that I did all those things in that really that 1 year period. It was just a busy time. You know,
it's amazing. I didn't think about it. Just mentioning it.
Right. I didn't think about it being, you know, that busy at the time. I guess I must have, but it's just that was a busy year for sure. A lot of projects. Working with Clea Blackhurst on the Hoagy Carmichael project was great. And we did that all over and we did an album of it. And, so many, you know, again, cause I love working with lots of different people. So I think I must've been happy that year for sure.
Well, then you toured with the Mel Torme show for a while, didn't you?
I did. I mean, I didn't go on a formal tour, but I've gone to Florida and I've gone to Texas and a lot of places in California. And done it. I still bring it out from time to time. I actually just did it virtually, filmed it for the St. Louis Cabaret conference, who I've done a lot of work for, and they're going to stream that as a private, a Zoom event, fundraising. You buy a ticket, kind of thing.
Funny,
I've done a few of those. So
I didn't know you did the Mel Torme album, which, by the way, I have to get now because I love Mel Torme. But I didn't know you did the tour and the album, and you were the reviews on your show are incredible. I even said you looked like him when you were
singing. Well, so funny because I would hear over the years, I mean, first of all, I was a huge fan, and I would hear over the years, practically since the time I was singing professionally, you know, people would say, oh, your voice reminds me, you kind of got the same range as Mel Torme, the same timbre. So I would get that. Plus, I was singing jazz and I was scat singing, so I was, you know, getting that comparison a lot. And I don't know why it took me so long to actually get around to doing it, but that was a period of my life when I was, I think, absolutely looking for a new solo project that I could book and tour around. So I researched it quite a bit and I made a nice, you know, 90-minute show out of it. And it was great fun to do because there's so many great songs. So, you know.
When you did the Cole Porter, the two nights of Cole Porter on Billy's Place,
which
to me was absolutely incredible. You sang Night and Day, and I went, oh my God, now I hear the Mel Torme. You just touched a little bit there on Mel Torme, just a little bit.
Well, I'll take it. I don't mind that. He was a fantastic singer. What a vocalist he was.
Ooh. And you know what? You're pretty hot yourself. I mean, you're really, I love listening to you sing, and I don't like listening to too many people on just the piano.
Right, right. Well, thank you very much for that. You know, it's funny, just piano came out of, I mean, I don't ever work with just piano, very rarely. I'm always working with the trio. So that just came out of all of a sudden we're locked in. So, and then I started to really enjoy it more. And then I got the idea to do the album and do it with just piano. And first of all, you know, it was true to what Billy's Place has been. But at the same time, it was very economical to make because there was just me, my friend Wayne Hahn, who produced it, and the engineer and his assistant. So there was four of us. We had the whole studio, and there was it was big. We weren't like trapped in a tiny place. And we had it for a day to record and a day to mix. So it felt very safe, for one thing. This was in August, and I was like, should I go? I hadn't gotten on a plane yet. And finally, they were like, come on, it'll be, you know, and it was, and I'm glad. And felt very safe, and I'm really proud of it. And I hear, you know, that I mean, singing all these years, you know, it just does deepens your connection to the lyric. You know, I've become so much more about the lyric.
There's so many Sinatras out there. I don't know people doing Mel Torme.
I don't know why there's so many Sinatras out there. I mean, I love his music as much as the next guy, but
sure.
I don't think, you know, everyone seems to just dive in and just do those songs. And, you know, nobody did them better than Frank Sinatra. It's fine to do a few songs in an evening, but there's so many tribute acts or people who are going to sing, you know, and it's like, I don't know. That's really not for
me. Well, he was kind of the king of cool for his generation.
Absolutely. I mean, he's certainly the beloved, you know, but there are other
Mel Torme
singers.
Oh my God.
And I wasn't, and so often so many of these people try to really imitate Frank Sinatra's phrasing and sound too. That's mm-hmm. not what I do with the Mel Torme thing. I mean, it's very much me singing the material, and I've rearranged some things, but just to tell his story coming up from very humble beginnings and in Chicago, and then getting discovered at the age of four. He was discovered, he and his family would listen to the radio. And one of the big radio broadcasts was an orchestra called the Coon Sanders Orchestra. And they would do a live thing on Sunday nights. And so his family would listen to it. And from the time Mel was like able to stand, he was like singing along, and, you know, he just picked it up. He just was like, had this incredible thing. So when they were, you could tell I've told this story, but when they were, when Mel was four, they went to have dinner. They went there on a Sunday night to see the band live and have dinner, and all got dressed up, and he was dressed in a little sailor suit, and he's still in the back of his chair, and he sang along with the band the whole time. And great, you know, but attracted attention. And so they brought him to the talent competition, and, you know, that they were doing on Mondays. And he sang with the band. And the first song he sang with the band was "You're Driving Me Crazy." Can you imagine a four-year-old singing
wow.
that? And he was such a hit. He got hired the next Sunday to come back. He got a five-month gig with this band, singing three songs a night, one night a week, free dinner for the family, and paid $15 a week for doing it at the wow. age of four.
Wow.
And then became a little radio star as a child star in radio. So
as a teenager, he had his own trio.
Oh, yeah.
But I want to get back to you.
Yeah, I do too.
So as you mentioned before, 2009, you did the show with Liza. Now, you've been doing solo now for a long time before that. Was
yeah,
there any I kind really of started... trepidation about going back and working? I mean,
well, it's always what I tend to return to, you know, when this job or this project or something, you know, is ending, because I know no matter what, I can always go back and do my own show. And I've been doing that so long now. My first one was in 1991, that first year I was in New York. So I've developed that, but it has gotten sidetracked with tours and other things with other people. But, I'm more excited about it now. You know, I love putting together new shows. I mean, this Billy's Place, all of a sudden I'm putting together new shows every week. So I've never worked that hard before. And, but it's great. You know,
once again, you were talking about the trio, and you're so good in collaborations. Mm. And that I think is really, not just a gift, but it's something you have to work on, because I've worked in collaborations, and I know that everyone has an ego. How Sure. do you deal in collaborations that make you so successful?
Well, I mean, it's just so much of what anything is, or certainly in a creative collaboration, it's like psychology, you know, and it's just, you know, the first rule of that is like, well, like I know things, but, to listen, to shut up and listen. You know, you don't have to always be the one talking all the time. And no. So you could kind of tell pretty soon into a situation if that's going to work or not, you know. And I've been very lucky to, you know, have felling with some people who really love to collab, and they can be quiet and listen, you know, and then and laughing. That's the biggest thing. If you can laugh, you know, it's like any other intimate relationship, you know, laughing and being able to listen. That applies to music. And I think that nature always was something I had, you know. I don't think I've ever had to really consciously try to become this. I think I've always kind of been a very empathetic, you know, sympathetic ear, and I like to listen and whatever, you know, that's just me.
Well, so also you're one of the nicest guys.
That helps.
At your level, I don't know anyone nicer. You just, yeah. You and Robert Wall and a few other people I know are just the nicest guys. And I think that helps a lot.
Texas helps a lot. I think that, you know, if you grew up in Texas, you certainly, you know, are raised that way. You know, I was raised right.
Well, I want everyone to go to Billy's Place on Thursdays. And they could go to Facebook Live. They could also go to BillyStritch.com, right?
Well, it doesn't go BillyStritch.com to get the albums, the CD.
Right.
But to watch Billy's Place, it's on my Facebook page, and that's okay. Billy Stritch. So, and that I broadcast through that. And then the shows are all on YouTube on my YouTube channel, which is Billy Stritch YouTube channel. So,
great. That's great.
Good.
Thank you so much for.
Well, thank you.